Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the KBOO Bike Show. Today we feature a show from the KBOO archives, and the topic is cyclocross racing. Hosts Tori and Jocelyn speak with Lawrence Malone, the godfather of cyclocross, Ryan Travone, and Sue Butler. That's all coming right up on KBOO. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop.
Good morning. I'm Tori Bortman here with my co-host Jocelyn Gowdy, welcoming you to the December KBOO Bike Show. Good morning, Jocelyn.
Hey, Tori.
As cyclocross racing winds down in the Pacific Northwest, things are just heating up nationally and internationally. For those who are uninitiated, cyclocross racing is on-road bikes, but off-road. You're racing as hard as you can around a short course for about an hour. Think of when you were a kid racing your friends through an empty lot, then add obstacles like stairs, sand, mud, and potentially having to dismount your bike to jump over things. It's a little crazy, it's a ton of fun, and the best cycling races for spectators, since there's many places to watch the action. Its roots are in Switzerland and Belgium, where the races are followed as closely as our nation follows football, including its own superstars, superfans, regular television coverage, and large contracts for racers. Here in the States, things are a little different, as the sport is, after 40 years, finally becoming legitimized. Today's guests will be sharing the history of cyclocross and their roles in it. Current two-time national cyclocross champion Ryan Travone is here with us, as well as the 2013 Masters World Champion Sue Butler. But first, cyclocross legend Lawrence Malone earned the title of Godfather of Cross for a really good reason. He was the original U.S. national champion and went on to become the five-time consecutive national champion from 1974 to 1979, a record that has still yet to be broken by any male racer. He was present for the birth of cyclocross in the U.S. and was with it as it took its first stumbling steps towards its current strong stance as a contending presence in the cycling world. Lawrence Malone has left and come back to the sport throughout his life, and he's here with us today to share his story of how cyclocross shaped him and what life was like as a cyclocross pro in the early beginnings of the sport. Oh, and Lawrence will be joining us in just a moment here. So I am going to actually bring in Sue Butler, who's here in the studio with us. Good morning, Sue. Sue is the 2013 Masters World Champion, has been racing for many years and recently retired. She's with us this morning to add another perspective to the glamorous lifestyle of cyclocross pro. With her trademark sense of humor and unending competitiveness, we're happy Sue could join us for the conversation this morning. Thanks for coming in, Sue.
Thank you.
So let's, since we've got you here, let's start and talk a little bit about how your career in cyclocross started.
Well, I didn't want to race cyclocross and was made fun of by the girls down at River City. They're like, you should race. You
have and River City's a bike shop.
It is. It's the local bike shop I've gone to for years, and they've supported me throughout my career. But I didn't want to try it, and then I tried it, and I did one race, and I was instantly hooked. And a couple of years later, I was racing on the world circuit. So it was a quick entry and a lot of fun.
Right, but you didn't start off as a cross racer.
No, I was a mountain biker, and I thought I wanted to be a mountain bike racer, but cyclocross kind of chose me because I was a little bit better at it than mountain biking.
Okay, and you were not, as some of our other guests today that we're going to speak to, you were not... Early, you didn't start your career early in your life.
No, I was about 34. I think I finally
I don't want to say you were
old,
but
35.
Like,
I was. But for... I was usually racing against people that almost could be my daughter. So, yeah, I mean, it was interesting being older, getting into the sport.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to invite Lawrence Malone to join the conversation. Lawrence, are you there now?
Yes.
Hi. Good morning. I'm so glad you could join us. Now, you started racing cyclocross much earlier than Sue did.
Yeah, I think they were the Paleolithic times.
and rumor has it you actually started cycling in the womb. Is that true?
Well, I was along for the ride. My mother was, for her honeymoon, was doing a bike tour through Scotland, Norway, Britain, England. And I think she carried me until her fourth month or fifth month or something. So I had this prenatal, you know, but I always used a bike as a kid, you know, for transportation. That's the main link.
And when you came into cyclocross in its infancy in the U.S., it was nothing like what Sue came into when she started, we'll just say a few years ago, Sue, when she started a few years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about what cyclocross looked like then?
Well, I saw my first race in the fall of 73 after my first road racing season. And I watched the race at Santa Cruz, and Santa Cruz was sort of the center at the time for Northern Cal cyclocross. And I remember thinking, these guys don't just mount very smoothly or they don't run very fast. And I thought I could do okay at that. But it wasn't until the following year I did my first cross race, and that just led to, you know, a series of races taking me to the world's team trials in New Jersey and then on to Europe.
What made you think that you could do that better than they could?
You can just tell. I mean, some people know how to dance. I don't know how to dance, but I certainly know how to get off on and off a bike fast.
And where did you learn how to do that?
Partly just growing up, and that's the whole thing with cyclocross, is it's so much if you relate to your bike and not just, you know, it's not just being on a turbo trainer. It's a whole life, I hate the word lifestyle thing. You use your bike, you carry it upstairs, you know, I lived in the country in Ojai, California, so there were a lot of dirt roads. So you just learn how to kind of get on really quick, get off really quick, although I never knew the proper, leg between the frame and right leg between the frame and left leg dismount. I was finally, you know, informed of that on my way to Europe the first year.
But so you kind of just grew up and grew into it and kind of stumbled into it. When you did go to Europe, what was that first European racing experience like?
Utterly humbling. I wasn't used to being lapped, you know.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what your, after you had started racing in that first year, what was your first year of racing in the U.S. like?
The first year of, you mean road or cyclocross?
Cyclocross.
The first year was 74, and like I said, Dan Knoll was kind of the dean of American cyclocrossers at that point, and he actually braised cantilevers on my old Girardengo. It's an Italian road bike, I think, built in Italian prisons. It wasn't a pretty bike, but it was effective. And Dan took me to my first race, and I ended up getting, we were 1-2 in that race, and that's just kind of how it stayed, always me and Dan. And then they had the Nationals the following year for the first time in Berkeley. But it was schizophrenic because the American scene, I could win races, but in Europe it was, you know, humbling. So I never knew quite where I stood.
So Europe, tell us a little bit about what that first Europe trip looked like. Did you have sponsorship to get over there? Did you pay for it out of your pocket?
I basically had to borrow some money. I got a little bit of help from my club, which was Touring Bike Co-op out of Chicago. But I had to actually come home early before the world because the U.S. Cycling Federation didn't support us. And that was only the beginning. I mean, and I left before I did a series of pro-am races before the World Championships, and then just in despair, I didn't have the $40 a night for a Swiss hotel room. $40 in 1974 is a lot of money, and I just came home early, and of course that angered the American cycling community. It's as if I went AWOL, but hey, if you're going to send someone off to war, support them, you know?
Absolutely. So it doesn't sound like you were getting a lot of support even you know, the fans wanted you there, and the and the cycling community wanted you there, but people weren't actually able to put their money where their mouth was.
Yeah, and that's understandable given what a kind of low-profile sport cycling in general, and especially cyclocross, was in those days. But as time went on and you win a few more than a couple of national championships, then you start maybe expecting a little help. But even then, we'd go to the Worlds, and the Poles would look at us, "You poor things, you are from world's richest country, but you were having to, you know, wrench on your own bike or wash off your own bike." We didn't have a team mechanic for a few years there. We had to hire a local, you know, Italian kid to wash off the bikes.
And Lawrence, this is Jocelyn. What, could you explain why that was? Like, where was the support? Why wasn't it offered at that time?
There wasn't even that much support for the road team, which is, of course, the glamour sport. And, in fact, I preferred road racing. I much preferred road racing to cyclocross, and it was a great frustration to me that I never got to go to more, to, like, you know, the tours through Latin America. I did do the tour of Costa Rica as a member of the national road team a couple
years.
But
you did quite well during those tours.
Road was much more interesting to me than cyclocross. I think the reason is just it's the poor stepson of cycling, and it's a second tier. I mean, it's changed now, but back then it was pretty self-resourceful.
So he's Lawrence is saying talking a little bit about how it is to race in Europe, and that cyclocross is kind of the stepchild. Is that still?
Well, it was interesting when he said that, because that struck a chord with me as well. I think one of the reasons cyclocross doesn't get the support some of the other cycling disciplines does is because it's not an Olympic sport. So I think the funding that we see from USA Cycling goes to those sports that are actually Olympic sports. They keep trying, but it's kind of like one of those sports. It's like, well, is it a summer sport? Is it a winter sport? It's
kind of
a tweener sport.
Yeah.
It's not a snow sport, but it can be done on snow if it snows.
Didn't they have a couple – the 96 Olympics had a cyclocross? Paolette, the Italian woman, won it?
Oh, okay. So they did it at an exhibition.
An Olympic event in Atlanta, I think.
Mm.
The only time.
Yeah, and there was talk of it this last year, too, or, like, there's been talk about it again, but I just haven't heard anything about it. But it still is one of those sports that, I mean, you do pay for your way somewhat, unless you are the best or you're Katie Compton or, you know, the...
Well, you know, I guess my question would be, how many of those positions on a team, and I think Ryan's going to speak a little bit more like about this when he joins us, but how many team positions that are paid... salaries are there out there?
Well, the salaries are based on teams, but like when we go to the Worlds, I've been three times, there's one person that gets a full ride to go to Worlds.
One?
This year I read through it. I'm not competing anymore, so I haven't read through it, but actually they're going to start supporting more, and they're not making automatic selections actually pay to go. But I paid up to $1,500 of my money plus my flight ticket plus everything. I mean, it's just, yeah, you pay out of your own pocket.
And one person gets a free ride is that for the entire nation?
Right. And there's usually five women on the U.S. team when they go to Worlds.
It hasn't changed much, it seems like, because that was the case with me. One of the great incentives to win the Nationals was that whoever won the Nationals was the only rider who would get the full airfare, and all the rest had to either pay half or all.
Exactly. Still like that.
And you're competing against racers coming from European countries that have been supported financially through the entire season. I would imagine. Is that accurate?
Yes, but at least now we have a Saunier, we have people washing our bikes, we have mechanics. It's come a long ways, but I think there's still a long ways to be equal with some of the European teams that actually pay. But it's different between men and women, too. So I come from a women's perspective.
But I would think, Sue, that being a world champion, my understanding is you're probably the first American to win the world.
Oh, that was Masters. I'm not an elite
still,
world.
That's the world. It seems like you're deserving of some support.
Yeah. My community rallied and I did get support. But unfortunately, like I said, USA Cycling, it's not an Olympic sport. So the focus is definitely not on cyclocross. It's still the stepchild.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have Ryan Trebone on the line now, and I'd like to bring him in. He's a current racer for the Cannondale Cyclocross World Team and a two-time national champion. And Ryan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good morning, everybody.
Hi, Ryan.
Good morning, Ryan.
We are talking a little bit about how much cyclocross has or has not changed in the last, 40 years since. So Lawrence was saying that, I think he eloquently put it that cyclocross was and to some extent still is the kind of the stepchild of cycling, that it's not quite loved as much as some. Do you find that that's true?
I think it's not as popular. I think the fan base is more passionate, for sure. I just don't think it hasn't had quite as far reaching to the audience. You know, the whole idea of it, I don't think, really transcends to people that aren't actively interested in it, you know. But we definitely don't have, you know, the millions of people that the road racing gets for the Tour de France and stuff like that, but we definitely have a really good fan base, and they're knowledgeable and they're really excited about the sport. And for me, that's, you know, sometimes cooler and better to have than just a bunch of people that just want to look at it occasionally, you know.
And Sue and Ryan, just so Lawrence, because I don't know how much he's been, Lawrence, have you been very involved with the cyclocross scene in the last 5 or 10 years?
No, not at all. I did give a couple of seminars last year in Southern California, Santa Barbara and Ojai, you know, to basic, you know, in skills, cyclocross skills, but that's about it.
So I would love if Ryan and Sue, you could tell our audience and Lawrence a little bit about what the American culture and fan base is like here, and then maybe also compare that to what it's like in Europe. But let's start with what it's like, especially I'm from Portland. So, Sue, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, the thing about the U.S. cycling is our fan base is usually the athletes' families, and people that actually race cyclocross. Like, cyclocross isn't something you just go do. It's a race. I mean, you don't say, oh, I'm going to go cyclocross today, but you do go ride your road bike or mountain bike. So I think that's what Ryan was trying to, like we were saying, it doesn't have that greater reach to the audience. But in Europe, you have 20,000 people at the race paying €20 per person to go to these races. And I mean, to spectate.
No,
they pay
wild.
To spectate? Yes.
And okay, that's very different than in the US.
Exactly. But I can compare it to sort of like NASCAR or,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah,
something that, you know, they have clubs that support certain athletes. And it's just random. I mean, there's so many people and, you know, the people I stayed with, they'd call it a middle-class sport. So, you know, you have the farmers and everybody coming in their rubber boots and watching.
And this is in Europe?
Yes, in Europe.
And what's it like? Ryan, do you want to describe a little bit more what it's like here?
Yeah, you know, here typically it is, you know, it's friends and families and then fellow racers and stuff. You know, we're starting to get some bigger races that it's not so much just participant-driven, but, you know, where people come out and watch. That's in smaller areas, not smaller areas, but in, there's a smaller percentage of the races. You know, you get races like Vegas, and you get races like Boulder, and occasionally you get races in the Northwest where people, you know, they like cycling, and they like to come out and watch the events, and so they're not necessarily racing as well, they don't really have anybody in the race, but they just enjoy the atmosphere, enjoy coming out and watching events. You know, people talk about Europe, and they get, you know, 20,000 people. For me, I bet you 50% of those people aren't even there to watch the race. They're more just there to go to the party. You know, they always have like beer tents up. They're out there for just kind of the atmosphere. They don't really follow the racing. They kind of know about the racing, but they're more just there because they want to go hang out and get drunk in a field and, you know, eat food and have fun, you know, and that's just kind of, it's like something to do. So it's a
pastime.
You know, yeah, it's just,
so spectating in Europe is a pastime, whereas spectating here, I think, Ryan, you were saying that people are more passionate about it.
Well, I think so. I think because most people, you know, they race the races before us, and then they want to go out and they want to watch us race on there and see what we do differently and see, you know, just differences. And they follow the sport. You know, they look at the results online. They watch, you know, behind the barriers, or they look for all like the, you know, they watch all the super prestiges online when they're streamed live at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, and so the people they're excited about it. You know, and that's. It's cool. I appreciate that people are so interested in what you're doing, you know.
Does it make the tenor of how they cheer for you or how they're paying attention different between here and Europe?
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, here they're really boisterous. You
know, really? They're not? I would think with the alcohol in Europe in the field.
No.
No, it's a bunch of old men going,
The European way of cheering is four people, usually it's Finn Nice, everybody else gets almost crickets around the course.
No kidding.
There's another element to that. I experienced in Switzerland my first year, and I could not believe it because I was present at crashes in American road races and in cyclocross. And when Americans crashed, the spectators would, such that there were spectators, would all, oh, oh. But in Switzerland, I could not believe it when the first time I crashed, you know, covered with mud, tumbling down an icy, you know, cow pasture in Switzerland, the fans were laughing at me, and not just a lusty laugh of empathy, but a kind of cackle, like a ha 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 ha. And I got up out of the mud. I looked at these fans. How could you laugh? This is hard. I think I even said it to them. and then I gradually put that laughter out of my mind. But the European fans can be also very nasty. You know,
they're a little more into the heckling.
It sounds like. And then years later, after I was actually in a cafe in Zurich, right after the Worlds in 1980, my last Worlds, and all the people were watching the Winter Olympics, and all of a sudden the whole bar, let out a collective cackle. And I said, I remember that horrible laugh. We looked up at the screen, and a downhill skier was having a 60-mile-an-hour tumble, and they were laughing at her. And she was Swiss to boot. This was in Zurich.
So heartless,
you know.
I think that you have to earn their respect, you know, and you have to earn their tears. We're here, it's pretty freely given, you know. They're like, all right, you're out there, at least you're out there doing it there. It's like, well, we don't really care that you're out there. We want to see you out there doing well, you know. And so for them, it's like, I think they appreciate the effort more than, you know, they expect you to fail, right? When you're an American over there, they expect you not to be that good. And so, but when you do well, I think you earn kind of their respect and admiration, and then they'll start cheering for you in the races and stuff like that.
In the meantime, it's okay to laugh at someone else's misfortune.
Totally. Why not? You know, like, we all laugh at ourselves, so I don't mind if someone else laughs at us as well.
Well, and I think that also comes back to, as a spectator and definitely amateur racer myself, I know I have some sense, a small sense of what you're going through out there, because now my pushing myself as hard as I can is nowhere near what you guys can do. But I know what it's like to try to push to my limits out there. And so when I see you trying as hard as you can, because that's really, you know, I think, Ryan, we talked about this a little bit before in previous conversation, that, you know, road racing, you're kind of out there, you're hanging out, you're just hanging out until somebody makes a move, and you're not pushing yourself as hard as you can the entire time. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit more of a strategy. Whereas on the cross, you're really just redlining it the whole time. And I think as a spectator who's raced before, I want to cheer for you just because you're going.
Where in Europe, most of them don't ride or race, so they just find entertainment in it, perhaps.
So, Lawrence, you went on, after your racing career, to become, after you were the 5-time consecutive national champion, you stopped racing completely. What happened there?
Well, I got a bit discouraged. I was only 26, and I got a little discouraged by the lack of sponsorship. That was the primary thing. I also wanted a change. I moved to Rome, and I was a writer. I was writing early articles for Velo News and all kinds of cycling magazines, and I got a job in Rome as an editor, and I just enjoyed the literary life for a change. But, you know, I always rode my bike, that's for sure, and it wasn't until 84 when Specialized lured me out of retirement to ride on their first mountain bike team, and that was the only year I actually made a decent income for racing all those years.
And I know, Ryan, that's changed a little bit, and Sue, you can speak to this a little bit as well, but Ryan, you're able to actually earn a salary to a certain extent now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when I first started, I mean, we all race for free initially, right, until you have to get to a point where there's some marketable value to having you there, either by winning races or your personality, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's gotten to a point now, like, when I first started racing, we were paid to race. You know, I was saying mountain bike was the expectation during the summertime, and then cyclocross was the expectation during the wintertime, so we raced year-round. So now it's worked, you know, cross has gotten to the point where not everybody, but a handful of us, you know, by a handful, I mean probably 3 or 4 people.
So not even a full hand.
Yeah, so, I mean, we can, you know, I mean, the majority of my income comes from racing cyclocross, you know, and it's taken a long time, you know, to get to that point where it was kind of self-sustaining. And, you know, I'd like to see it continue to grow more, but at the same time, you know, you can't expect, people just can't expect to go out there and make money doing it unless they have something to offer. You know, you have to build up your name and your brand and stuff and have something that's worth selling to someone. You know, and so a lot of people go, oh, well, you know, like, it'd be really nice to get paid. And it's like, well, yeah, everybody thinks it's really nice to get paid, but, you know, it doesn't come from nowhere, you know. it's nice. And I'm really excited that cyclocross has got to the point where, you know, I can make that the primary focus of my season, you know, and take the rest of the summertime and the springtime to kind of work into that, you know. And it's good to see. You know, I'd like to see it grow more. I'd like to see the races get bigger, you know, more depth of the competitors and stuff. But, you know, it'll happen eventually. You just can't expect huge changes, you know, in year after year.
What struck me that year, Ryan, when I raced mountain bikes for Specialized, how much of my cyclocross background gave me an advantage. But then within only about 4 years, suddenly that cyclocross background wasn't so much of an advantage, because suddenly you had these guys with BMX background who could just do fabulous things on the bike, or motocross skills even. I mean, in the 77 world, one of the reasons I got sponsored in Europe following that was they had a barrier only 40 centimeters high. Any American kid on a BMX bike could have jumped over it. But for some strange reason, European convention kept everybody into dismounting for the barrier instead of bunny hopping it. Well, only me and Eric DeFlemick, I believe, he was a pro, Roger DeFlemick's brother, we were the only ones to bunny hop it, and so they popped a picture, a centerfold picture of me doing it in Miroir de Cyclisme, the French cycling, and that got me sponsorships from then on. But it was any little BMX kid could have done that, you know? No big deal.
I still can't do it, so.
So you raced in 84, and then a few years later, you had this kind of crazy, momentary comeback in Bremerton, Washington for Nationals in 1990. You just showed up and kind of dominated. Can you talk a little bit about how that even came about, and if you were trying, were you going to try to start your pro career again, or what was going on?
Well, I was only like 36 or something then. But I didn't have any illusions. In fact, I way underestimated myself. I thought I was kind of washed up. But it was a really snowbound year in Santa Fe, winter, and there was a lot of running, and it turned out the Bremerton course was suited for not just running, but for the speed variations, you know, how well you downshifted in preparation. There were a lot of up and down, and when you chose to dismount. I mean, a lot of cyclocrosses, when to go slow or as well as when to go fast. And I was even in races where, with, you know, Tom Prenn, national road champion at the time, when he would accelerate into turns that you had to, you know, brake just to get through. There was no sense in, you know, using all that gasoline and all that braking power. I would just cruise up. I mean, anyway, the Bremerton thing surprised me. I won the veterans class. I thought, well, maybe I'll ride with the young guys, the main event. Well, Don Myra dusted everybody, but I got third. And then I was wishing that I had, you know, just concentrated on the main race instead of the veterans.
And you decided that didn't reignite the fire to keep racing, or?
Well, actually, I got a little more notice because cyclocross interest was starting to pick up, and Bridgestone came through and built me a couple of nice bikes. It was really nice, you know, and sent me to a couple of the following nationals after that. But that was after having coached the national team for a time, and that was pretty instructive in itself, this national cyclocross team.
Yeah,
early
80s, 81 to 85. To talk to you a little bit about you coached some an entire generation of some of the top racers from the U.S. as cyclocross was really maybe going from its infancy to its toddler stage. Did you enjoy coaching? And if so, like, what was kind of your philosophy and your style of coaching?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoy imparting knowledge such that I have. You know, I also was wary of overcoaching because I saw a lot of athletes, it's interesting because cycling, when you train for cycling events, you're pretty much on your own. You deal with car traffic. I found the cyclists at the Olympic Training Center more worldly than other athletes, say swimmers who train in kind of laboratorial conditions back and forth in a swimming pool, or even track riders. And especially the track people, it was all about what the coach told them to do. And cyclists tended to have a lot, to show a lot more initiative. That was interesting in itself, that cycling, or sometimes they're considered an uncoachable breed. So I had that challenge. But I had also some really good races. Unfortunately, Eddie Borisovitz, the head coach, didn't let me take Roy Nickman to the world, because he was truly pretty promising. That guy can do wheelies on his road bike.
Okay, well, I want to hear a little bit more about that, but right now we need to take our midway break. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on 90.7 FM in Portland, on the web at www.kboo.fm. Please stay with us for the second half of our show when we'll continue this excellent conversation with Lawrence Malone, the godfather of cyclocross, Ryan Trebone of the Cannondale Cyclocross World Team, and Sue Butler, the 2013 Masters World Champion. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. Good morning. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO-FM. We are here with Ryan Trebone of the Cannondale Cyclocross World Team, Sue Butler of the 2013 Masters World Champion, and Lawrence Malone, the godfather of cyclocross, talking about the differences between cyclocross in Europe and the U.S. And before we took a short break there, Lawrence, you were about to talk a little bit about coaching, and I know we had discussed the differences between coaching European athletes and American athletes, and you had some interesting things to say about what made America kind of special versus Europe.
It's funny you mention that, because at the time I was racing, we American racers suffered from a real inferiority complex vis-a-vis the Europeans. Oh, they're just so much better than we are. You know, and it was a big breakthrough in 1976 when George Mount got, I think, fifth at the Montreal Olympics in the road race, and then followed shortly by Mike Neal getting 10th in the World Pro Championships road race. And suddenly it's like, wow, we can do it. You know, there was this, but, you know, this was still 5 years away from Le Mans. And but what I had to deal with you know, besides the difference in sponsorship that Europeans got and the attention and care, when I was coach, I felt that I was in a little bit of a conflict between the Eastern European training philosophy, because at that time, because the Eastern Europeans were pulling in so many gold medals in international competition, America felt that it had to adopt a Eastern European formulas, and they hired Eddie Borisovitz, an immigrant from Poland, actually a defector. He defected at Montreal, and he knew time trials, but I don't think he really understood the American racing psychology, and I think Americans, too, underestimated their own genius. And I witnessed that firsthand when I was at the OTC and seeing Alexei Grewal, who was told at that time, you'll never make the Olympic road team, you're too much of an individual. And he ends up being the only automatic qualifier, and he wins the gold medal race in L.A. And it sort of proved to me that America, because he followed very much, he didn't follow Eddie Borisovitz's training regimen, he followed his own. And I think America has to recognize its own genius, its philosophy of training, let's say.
And Ryan and Sue, you can each maybe speak to what's your training philosophies like? As in this more modern time of power meters and really, really tight and regimented kind of training plans. Sue, did you want to start?
Well, I just did what my coach told me to. When I started racing, I had no idea what I was doing, and I was very new at cycling in general. So I hired a coach right off the bat, Kendra Wenzel, and she basically brought me through my whole career until I retired. So I just did what she said.
And so you didn't really vary much from that.
Well, she said.
How regimented was it, though?
I mean, I'm a rare athlete if you ask her, because I did everything. She said I didn't ask questions. I didn't like say, oh, I don't feel like doing this today. I just felt like I had to do what she told me to do, and I was paying her, so I might as well do it. And yeah, it was. I was very regimented, but I also had the unique opportunity to leave my job and focus on training and racing.
And Ryan, how about you?
You know, I don't think it's so much the actual training aspect that is a huge difference between the European racers and maybe the U.S. racers. I think it's just the overall kind of, it means the racing. The racing is just different. You know, the courses are different. The conditions are, the tempo of racing, kind of how things play out. And so, you know, it's just, it's not one of those things that, like, you can train for. It's just one of those things you have to adapt to and get used to by, you know, doing a bunch of racing. And so it's, I think that was the main difference of why people have become more successful, say in the road racing and the mountain bike and the cyclocross, is like the more you do something, the better you're going to get at it, you know? And so spending time in the U.S. racing doesn't really prepare you for what, you know, like a European classics road race is like, or what like a World Cup is like in Belgium, just because, you know, the conditions are different. The way they race them is different, you know? And so if you want to be good at, you know, that.
Can you give me an example of how it's different?
Well, you know, when we race in the U.S., I mean, the courses are typically, they're not, I wouldn't say they're less technical here. They're just the soil composition's different, you know, the way the race, I mean, obviously the speed's faster. But it's just, for some reason over there, the ground, you know, I don't know if it's just because of the way that they've been farming them forever. And typically we race on like grass parks here where it's rolled sod and it's smooth and it's, you know, it's never really been used for much besides being a park. Is we're there, you're in fields, and you know, and the fields are tilled year after year. And so it's like a really clay, sandy soil. And when it's muddy, it's super greasy, you know. And those kids, they grew up racing, you know, from they're 14 years old. And they, one of the biggest things that it's taken me a long time to learn is tire pressure. You know, they start running, you know, they start training and racing on tubulars at, you know, 15 to 18 PSI, and so they're really comfortable in low pressure, and with low pressure you get more traction. As we're here, you know, most of us start racing on clinchers and you're on them at 45 PSI, and so, and they just ride differently, you know, and it takes a while to get used to the way a bike handles with 18 PSI in it versus 35, you know, so, it just takes time and practice, you know, and those guys have a head start on us, but I think we're slowly catching up, you know. A lot of the junior programs they have now are doing a really good job, you know, and you can see some of the results that the kids have had over the last couple of weeks, you know, winning races in Europe, and that's a big deal, you know. Like, to be a 16 or 18 year old kid and go over there and win races is hard, you know, because those 18 year old kids over there are fast, you know, they're no joke.
And I think one of the other differences is to proximity. Over there, all the races are fairly close together, and they drive to the races, whereas here in the United States, I mean, we fly from one part of the country to the other part of the country. So the differences, maybe like you were talking soil or, you know, where they are, it's where they can get the locale. Whereas in Europe, I mean, because it's so established, they have these venues, they've had them for years, and they can drive to them. So I think when the Europeans come over here, they're like, what the heck? You have to get on a plane to go? I remember being at a baggage claim with my bikes, and Sven Nys looks at me and goes, you travel with your bikes? I'm like, yeah, I do. I have to. So it's just, it's different.
How many bikes did you take with you traveling?
Two, always two. Got to have two. The lucky people have more because they actually had, you know, support and mechanics and stuff, but self-supported, two.
Did you have a mechanic, Sue?
Not usually. Only when I was on the world's team. I begged, borrowed, and stealed most of my career.
Is this the case? Because I had a conversation maybe 5 years ago. Jeff Proctor, I think for a time he was national team coach of the cyclocross team. This was maybe 7 years ago. He called me up out of the blue, and he says, unfortunately, Lawrence, it's the same situation as it was back in 1982, that we're just not getting in. And I think he mentioned that there were not even – it was tough to even get a mechanic onto the world's team, or at least pay a mechanic's way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, if you have a trade team that goes over there and supports you, like, I know Ryan's usually had a mechanic, but they're all – the U.S. people stick together over there, too, and I think everyone helps each other out because, I mean, we're over there and we don't have a home. We are not – we don't have our big Winnebagos and trailers and stuff because we flew over there. So – you know, there's always some support and camaraderie over there, which was always nice.
I had a real challenge in the 85 Worlds as coach, setting up the American pit. And I got there early, and I set it up at the optimal place just before this run-up where you're going to have to dismount anyway. And then I had to go to the other side to set up the other pit. And when I got back to the pit number one, the Czech national team, about 22 guys in identical blue jackets, all burly, had shoved our bicycles in my pit and our buckets down, way down the line. And they basically just uprooted me, and I was pissed.
Well, now they assign them at a meeting the night before.
That's good.
Let's talk about inviting the Europeans over to American soil to race, because last year cyclocross worlds were held in the U.S. for the first time. I believe that was in Louisville, Kentucky, correct?
Yep.
So I'd like to hear from both Sue and Ryan about how they thought that changed the playing field and, you know, any feedback that you got from European racers. And of all places, why Louisville, Kentucky? You don't necessarily consider that to be a cycling culture hub, a place where you would bring international athletes to participate.
They actually have a great cycling community there, and they had a great bid, obviously, to get the Worlds there. I actually didn't compete. I did spectate, so Ryan can speak more as a competitor. I did the Masters race that year earlier, but it was interesting. It was amazing to have that in the United States. And I mean, they learned what it was like to have to bring everything over. And I think it was a real eye opener to what we go through when we go over there. Luckily, USA Cycling does have a hub in Belgium, so at least there's a home. They've recently moved, and I've heard it's a lot nicer, but I have not been there.
Ryan, can you speak to any feedback you heard from the European racers coming over here?
Yeah, you know, I think there's always some reservation, you know, right? The European, they don't like just a lot of change, but, you know, I think once they came over and they realized, yes, we could put on a good race, and, you know, the crowds are fantastic. You know, the crowds are louder at the Louisville Worlds than any race I've ever done in Europe, bar none. You know, like, there was probably half as many people as a normal Worlds, but they were just more into it. They were really excited, and they were stoked to be there, and all the racers had a great time. You know, it was a weird scheduling conflict. You know, like, we had problems, they had to push the race forward a day, and
was there a storm? Flood.
You know, the river was flooding, and where the race is, it sits right on the riverbed, and they knew it was flooding, and they were pumping water out of the course and back into the river, you know, and so the day after the race, I mean, there was 2 feet of water on the course, and so the organizers did a great job just to make the event happen, you know, and it was awesome. I had a fantastic time. You know, I had a really good race going, took myself out, crashed, you know, and stuff happened, but it was still overall, I think, a really good weekend. And I think it's helping grow across in the U.S., and I think it's getting Europeans more willing to come over after that as well. You've seen people come over from Vegas now. You know, it's been nice the last couple of years. So it was good. You know, it's I don't really think, you know, having a race over here levels the playing field, because, you know, those guys aren't better because the races are in Europe. They're faster because they're just faster, you know, and it makes things slightly more convenient for us and slightly more inconvenient for them, but that's not a big enough difference to say, like, oh, well, if we have a race in the U.S., we're going to win the race versus going to Europe. Like, if you're good, you're good if the race is in Belgium, or if you're good if the race is in the U.S., you know. So I think sometimes people like to see it as the races being over there is an excuse for poor performance versus just, you know, another thing you have to deal with. And, you know, yeah, it's harder traveling over there, but it's not a reason for you to finish.
Would you echo what Sue said about that the racers, I don't, got a taste of what it was like to be an American coming over to Europe?
Sort of. It's a lot. You know, the way that their organization, you know, the Belgian organization travels is a lot different than the way that we as the USA Cycling travels, right? So those guys, they hired like a shipping container, loaded up all the equipment, shipped it over here on the airplane versus saying, hey, you know, we're all going to fly in there and we'll pick you up from the airport. And, you know, the amount of equipment.
So it kind of comes back to that, like, analogy of pro football in the United States. Cyclocross is like pro football. There's money behind it. If the pro football team wanted to go over and to Europe and for some reason and play football, somebody's gonna have some money to send them over there and make sure they're taken care of. And that money just isn't behind it in the U.S. But it is for cyclocross. Those racers coming over from Europe.
Yes, I mean, they definitely, it means a lot to them. You know, like, they invest a lot of money into it. Their national governing body pays them if they win Worlds, right? There's a bonus for winning the World Championships, you know. As for us, we just get reimbursed for our travel there, right? If you win...
But you get all that honor and glory, right?
Well, you get that too, but you know, that's not $100,000. Whatever the Belgians, I think they pay, the organization pays the team out. You know, so that's, I mean, that stuff's an incentive to, as well. And so for them, it's like, you know, what's $5,000 to ship equipment over when we're already going to spend, you know, five times that on everything else. So,
but Ryan, what you say that Europeans are simply faster. I mean, I think you're right, but it was kind of a revelation for me when I was one time in Holland and I saw a very old, decrepit-looking Dutch grandmother doing a two-wheel drift on an icy patch on her old Dutch bike. And I thought, no wonder these guys are so good, because everybody cycles. And cycling is part of the cultural fabric, not like here, you know?
I agree.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to the financial thing, too. I mean, Tori and I touched on this earlier about the financial. Like, in Europe, they pay to go see races, and the athletes don't pay to race.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about start money, which is this concept I had never heard of until Sue enlightened me. Sue, can you talk a little bit about start money? And I guess start money has been around since Lawrence's time.
Yeah. There's actually, I didn't know about it either until someone told me I should ask for it. But I never got a lot of it, but they actually would give you like 100 euros, 150 euros. I'm sure like Sven Nys and some of the better races, maybe even you, Ryan, because you're 6'6" or whatever, you get more money. But I mean, they'll pay you to start the races, you know, not the World Cups, but the other races to be on that start line.
Yeah, they used to, I mean, the World Cup used to pay, consider travel money based on
right.
your UCI ranking. So if you're 10th in UCI ranking, you got X amount. If you're 20th, you got X amount. You know, and the races, I mean, the super prestigious and the smaller races that pay start money, it's not just like, oh, we like Sven Nys, we're going to pay him, you know, 10,000 euros to come to the event. You know, it's kind of based off, they go, Sven Nys is going to come to the race, he's going to draw 10,000 more spectators to come just because he's here, and they're going to pay $10 to come in. So for us to pay him 10,000 euros means nothing, you know, it's like, it's a no-brainer. Like, you get four times the revenue to have one guy come, you know, and that's why I think people don't understand is like, well, it'd be nice to make 10 grand, but it's like, you know, I couldn't go there and ask for €1,000 start money because it'd be like, well, are you going to bring, is it going to make us more money? Are you going to bring more spectators having you here? The answer is probably no. You know,
it's a business.
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, those guys aren't out. I mean, most people put on races in the U.S. because they enjoy a race and they may make a little bit of money off doing it, but they want to have a race come. They enjoy seeing the race come, and it's just like it's a passion project for them. As over there, it's like, you know, this is what we do for a living, you know. And so that's why the races are bigger. That's why they're better, more well organized, and that's why more people come, you know.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting something that Lawrence touched on, that it's, you know, it's in the culture. It's in the culture so much that it is a business. But it's even in a non-business sense part of the culture for the everyday cyclist in Europe. And Lawrence, I know your passion has kind of shifted a little bit more from cyclocross to everyday cycling and making roads safe and accessible.
It's a continual challenge, you know that. I mean, every cyclist knows that. You know, I was hoping that I didn't read all of Lance Armstrong's book, but I remember he didn't touch a whole lot on the challenge just to train on public roadways on a bicycle is at least as great as the challenge you face in a bike race. And, you know, I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or near there, and that, you know, bicycles are sort of an afterthought. And, you know, I get more and more militant over the years. I'll take up entire lanes because, you know, I just gamble that the motorists' hearts are bigger than their brains. They're not going to run me down on purpose, but they certainly will kill me accidentally, and they'll call it an accident. So take over the lane and don't hug the gutter, you know? That's kind of been my philosophy. Anyway, and I've
lobbied with the passion and that
planning issues and put my voice in, but generally ignored.
Do you think that passion, that you can put that passion to use to kind of that, to make it a bigger part of the culture here and maybe change how, help that, do you think that'll influence maybe how cyclocross is seen in the future?
Well, I, not just cyclocross, but all forms of cycling. I've been an advocate of, say, bike education. I've actually drawn up grant proposals, never had them come through, for comprehensive bicycle education programs in schools. You give kids that knowledge of how to conduct themselves in traffic, there's a better chance they'll use their bike more, and and mom and dad aren't going to worry so much about them, and they'll actually ride their bikes to school. When I was a kid, the bike racks were filled with schools, even in fourth grade. But that's 1965 or something. Now I go past the school, and there's a long line of mommies and Range Rovers, you know, waiting.
Unless
to
you're in
Union.
Portland.
Yeah, and Portland's a little bit different, but definitely in Santa Fe I can see where that's going to be the case. The other thing that's interesting that I found, and I don't know if any of our guests are involved with it, but I've seen a growing surge in, speaking of education, in high school mountain biking as a sport. And
cyclocross.
Junior cyclocross growing, and I think in Oregon we even have cyclocross as kind of a high school series.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you been involved with that, Sue?
I have not been involved, as much as I should be. I kind of took a step back this year, but I think that's what this country needs as we see cyclocross go, is a little development in the younger years. And like Ryan said, you're seeing these juniors now go to Europe and they're winning races. That didn't happen. And so we're getting to that level. I don't think the racers are better. I just think getting people over there, exposing them to the courses in Europe, exposing them to the racing in Europe, the comfort level goes up, the skills get better. And
well, and also more people racing, especially more young people racing, makes the competition more fierce. And the fiercer the competition, the faster you got to go.
Yes, it does. I mean, the women and men, I think there's some disparity there also, but we do. I mean, Katie Compton's one of the fastest in the world. So on the women's side for America, I think we just have fantastic racers. And, you know, there's three or four in the top 10 every World Cup. So that's a good start.
That's a really good start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it going to take to get cycle
between funding for men's cyclocross and for women's?
Oh, I mean, you know, I think the money, there's still some disparity in that as well, but it's getting there. At least here in the United States, they're paying equally at the races, most of them. And there's a petition to do it in Europe. I'm not racing right now, so I don't know how that far that's gotten. But, you know, they actually have women's races at some of the super prestige in the, where they used to not even have a women's race, they actually have a women's race now. So it's getting there. It's slow, but, you know, change is slow.
Not even a women's race, but different categories for women's races, too, including a single-speed race.
That doesn't happen in Europe. It's only elite racing.
Oh, okay.
So you go to any of these races, there's not all the categories we have over here. It's basically elite men, elite women, the juniors, and the espoirs or the under 23. So
and democracy.
Yeah, and there's not like an under 23 women's or a junior women's.
No unicycle categories there?
No. it's only serious stuff.
Well, yeah, that goes a long way, I think, to illustrate the difference between the culture here and the culture there as well.
So. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do have races, but they're at other venues at other times.
Sure.
And it's not as big for the normal person. Mm-hmm.
You're going to a professional sporting event.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, in Lawrence, I don't think you've gotten to experience our kind of cyclocross culture here in Portland. I'd love to invite you to come up sometime and visit us.
I would love to see. You told me there were like some 4,000 people in the participating one weekend.
1,200 a day, I would say,
yeah.
Is average.
That's just mind-blowing.
Yes.
It's sure different from
our
ragged
circus.
Lot.
No, it's a big old party.
It's a circus. It's a party. And it's loud. It's really loud. And I would say one of the amazing things, we didn't really talk about this because we've been talking about pros, but one of the things, you know, beyond juniors, we've even got a huge kiddie cross series that starts so that kids can start racing cross when they're on their scoot bikes here. So, you know, we're starting them young with hopes that it sticks and they want to keep.
There's going to be some good cyclocrossers coming out of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, for sure.
What amazes me is, you know, cyclocross is naturally suited to being televised. You can get up closer. The courses are fairly closed circuit. Does Portland TV cover races?
No.
They should.
They
because
should.
In Europe, I mean, everybody
that could
watches
really launch, it. You know, launch the sport.
Yeah. It's well, right now it's our hidden secret in cyclocross culture that there's this really fun thing that you should come. What's funny is a lot of them happen in neighborhoods, and the neighbors are finally catching on to this, that they'll walk over and see what it is because they're like, "Wow, why is our neighborhood suddenly got 3,000 people and who's this parking on my lawn?" It's interesting that it's kind of had a little bit of a spread that way.
Well, I think a part of that too is that it's we don't have a lot of races in town either. So hopefully we can start seeing some cyclocross races back in Portland proper. So.
And we have had an awesome time having you all on the show today. Big thanks to our guests, Lawrence Malone, the Godfather of Cross, Ryan Trebon of the Cannondale Cyclocross World Team, and Sue Butler, the 2013 Masters World Champion. If our guests or anyone listening or podcasting would like to hear more about what you guys are doing, how can they follow you? Ryan?
I don't know. At the races. Any variety.
You don't have a Twitter account? There's no...
Yeah, I do. Just Ryan Trebon. Pretty much Ryan Trebon, anything.
And if they want to figure out which races you're going to be at, how do you figure that out?
Cannondale Cyclocross World website typically has most of all the information on all our racers and all our sponsors and the schedule we do, and that'd be the number one place I'd go look for things.
And Sue, I know you're not racing anymore, but...
My whole life of racing is at SueButlerRides.com.
If you want
great reading there.
And Lawrence, you have a breadth of writing. As you said, you're a published writer, and there's lots of stuff out there about you. Where would you direct people if they wanted to find out more about you?
I don't really have a website. I'm kind of 19th century. Just my name at Gmail is my Gmail account. That's about as far as it gets from me.
That's great. And thank you for all the work you're doing to make the road safer down there in Santa Fe. I mean to get down there sometime in the winter when we're sick of Portland rain.
Thank you.
We have one quick announcement today. If you are out looking for those last-minute holiday gifts, there's a pretty cool event going on this
weekend. Yeah, are we last-minute already? Like weeks for
it's true. I was like, well, Thanksgiving's done, holiday shopping's over.
Commence buy-a-thon. The Bike Craft Holiday Gift Fair is this weekend, September 6th and 7th. Presented by Bike Portland, you'll find handmade, locally produced gifts, bicycle accessories, jewelry, art, fashion, paper goods, and more at this year's Bike Craft. It's happening at Bike Farm, which is at 1810 Northeast 1st Avenue. Free admission, food, beer, fun, plenty of bike and street parking. We will see you there.
Yes, and you have been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're broadcast from Portland, Oregon on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Alon Robb, Christopher Delaney, Jocelyn Gowdy, and myself, Tori Bortman. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy Dean, our web host, Chris Smith, and our editor, Josh Hetrick. We will be back to you in the new year. Woohoo! With more news and views from the cycling world. Until then, the happiest of holidays. Keep riding your bike.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. The information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. And also by Decom Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30 at Northeast Decom and 8th, entrance of on 8th, decomstreetdoorway.com. And by the way, any reference to that bike crafts craft show that Tori mentioned at the end of the bike show. This was a recorded, archived show, so disregard that. That's not happening. That was a September event. And okay, well, let's hear a little bit of music, and then, it's Nick. Nick is here, waiting in the wings to bring you jazz, and coming right up at the top of the hour. That is after the KBOO Noon News. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO today. Thank you.
This is KABU Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley is joining presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders in calling for a radical reduction to the exploration of fossil fuels on national land and in coastal waters, with legislation to be introduced today. Merkley announced in a conference call that these actions are necessary as good stewards of our planet, and he hopes the legislation will spark debate in Congress.
Beaverton School District may add as much as $20 million to the cost of the new high school it's building in South Cooper Mountain, bringing the total to approximately $166 million. This is one of seven new or rebuilt schools to be constructed with bond funds that will cost more than the original estimates. The bond funds have been bolstered to $750 million without adding any taxes.
According to a survey published today, Oregon State